Totally Football Show with today's top football stories. Midweek Champions League playoffs. Celtic astonishing with the Kazakhs vanishing, while Liverpool triumph with Trent Alexander-Arnold. Should he be the three first names on the team sheet? Across Stanley Park, Everton spend a huge amount of money on a Siggy. No wonder Wayne Rooney feels at home there. We ask, will Guilfoyle debut this weekend against Man City? And what will happen as Spurs face Chelsea, like we know? Plus, is this the season that you start watching Serie A again? That's coming up in a special bit at the end that you can skip. All in this Totally Football Show. And it's a big hello from me and from James Horncastle.
Hello, James.
You're sporting a new haircut today, James.
It's a little bit short, yeah.
Right, Michael Cox is here.
Hello.
Good to see you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
No, not at all. It is always a pleasure. And we've got David Priest here.
Hello, James.
Things must be bad because they've got the Priest in. Hey, if we had a Judas, we'd have Judas Priest. Where are we going to find a Judas from, though? I didn't realise this, but you and zonalmarking.net have beef.
Well, we don't have beef, but I've just mentioned that I'm assuming that at some time over the course of our Twitter relationship that we've had some disagreements.
Okay.
I've noticed that Michael quite likes a disagreement now and again.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Particularly with anyone, you know, involved in Northern football.
Perhaps I'm more of just a voyeur.
Oh,
yeah. Of his arguments.
Well, it's certainly
beefs.
You've both got very original ways of looking at the game. And so I suppose it's only inevitable that sometimes there's a little bit of friction. But I'm looking forward to a little bit of that today. And also the fact that you have got some interesting things to say about free kicks. In a kind of Game of Thrones parallel, we've got a bearded northern man who's going to take us beyond the wall. And that's later on.
Even knock the wall down, perhaps.
Really? Just take it out completely?
Just take it down, yeah.
Wow. Go around it.
That's exactly what the Night King would want.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, that's all good. What are you looking forward to this weekend, anyone, Michael?
Tottenham-Chelsea.
Yes.
That's a really big game, I think.
Mm, all right.
Last season's top two, Tottenham's first game at Wembley, or first, you know, proper home game at Wembley, home league game, and a Chelsea side who are really, really struggling, I think, in terms of, I mean, I know it's only one game into the season, but there's some really bad noises coming out of Stamford Bridge in terms of, you know, Conte's unhappiness. The front three that took them to the league last year are all unavailable this weekend. Fabregas is suspended. Cahill's suspended.
Hazard's not there. Pedro's not there. Bakayoko's still not ready.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really big game, I think.
It's a good time to face Chelsea.
Oh, definitely, yeah. If they get off to the start of the season with two defeats back-to-back, I think things could unravel as they did 2 years ago under Mourinho in that final half season.
All right, good time to face Chelsea. Is it a good place to face them, though, at Wembley? Because, you know, Spurs, Wembley.
Well, Chelsea beat them 4-2 in the semi-final of the FA Cup at Wembley last season. Well, we've seen what Spurs did in Europe last year as well. They lost 3-5 games there. But I was at the pre-season friendly where they played against Juventus. Both teams played, full strength sides, really. And Spurs looked really good. Pochettino, when he's not writing letters to newlyweds, as he did this week.
What did he write to a newlywed?
He said, "Remember in life, just like in football, a little teamwork can get you some great results." So, there you go.
That's nice.
It's nice of him to take the time out of game planning this game and congratulating these two lovers. Back to the game. I'm quite curious to see what Chelsea's approach is in this one, because I think, you know, Conte has shown that he can do a lot with little before in his coaching career. We saw that, for example, with Italy at the Euros, where kind of no one thought they could do anything, and instead they kind of shocked a lot of people. And we'll have to see what he has in mind. I mean, they've got no one really in midfield aside from Kante. So does David Luiz step into midfield, and then they play a completely new configuration at the back with Rudiger, Christensen, and Azpilicueta? There's a lot of things that might be new for Chelsea, that might be a good thing. It might be a bad thing. It could be a novelty, which is there to their advantage. There might not be the understanding there, which, you know, when you've got Kane and Ali coming at you. You don't really want to be going into those kind of games untested.
What you're saying is you just don't know at this point. Just don't know. Yeah, okay. Who's the best keeper, David? I'm not going to ask you exclusively goalkeeping questions today, but this one I will ask. Who's the better keeper? Who do you rather have, Lloris or Courtois?
That's a tough one. Probably De Gea.
Right.
Okay. But if you're putting out the two of, I'd say Lloris out of.
Why?
Simply because he stops the ball. With Lloris, he's got a sort of a big hole in his game when it comes to distribution. I think if anybody watches Tottenham week in, week out, they'll see that it's his big weakness. But everything else more than makes up for it. And I think the fact that I was really impressed with Tottenham at weekend, actually, and not in the way that we have been the last couple of seasons. It's always been, you know, we talk about their pressing game, we talk about their teamwork, but their movement, the way they moved Newcastle around the pitch on Sunday, it seems as if they've changed the game a little bit. Mm. And I think Christian Eriksen, he's key to that. Mm. The way that he created space for others, and that they're simply not just a pressing side and win the ball high up the pitch. They work the ball through the departments really well.
All right. So the change in their approach is they're a little bit less asphyxiating and a little bit more ball playing, is that?
There is that. I mean, you've got to say that Newcastle, they were never going to win the game.
Right.
They could have held it at 0-0 at best, and when Shelvey got sent off, then that was it, really. But the way that they spent, Newcastle really couldn't sort of impose themselves on the game at all, simply because they were so occupied with the movement of even the likes of with Dier getting the ball, Dembele, in the movement of the three in front of them. They were just occupied trying to cover those runs and the movement from them as well.
All right. Quite a few people tweeting in about Spurs' lack of activity so far on the transfer market and how much of a risk they're taking, Carl Whittingham among them. Do you have Spurs able to match last season's second place, better it, or are they going to struggle to make the top four?
They can certainly match it. I think sometimes it can be a strength. You know, you look at teams that come into the Premier League, the big trend that has been going the last few years, the teams have kept the successful teams together, Southampton, Swansea. They kept they added one or two signings to it, but mostly they kept the same squad. So they used to playing together, they know the game inside out. And that's why, you know, if I was Pochettino, I would have been furious last week with Danny Rose. It's not exactly what you want before the first game of the season.
No, every rose has its thorn. Michael, where do you have them in your predictions this year?
They were fourth for me, I think top four. I think they're a really good team. I think they'll continue to improve. They've got lots of players coming into their kind of peak ages. And I think they've had a fantastic transfer window. You know, to keep all those players, some of whom are the most highly rated players in the league, unquestionably the best centre-back pairing, Ali and Kane could get into any team. And they're staying with Tottenham without too much fuss, really. There hasn't been speculation. There's not this kind of Alexis Sanchez type, you know, speculation. And it's weird to me that people seem to define the transfer window and how successful teams have been simply by almost the number of players that are coming in. You know, you look at a team like Everton or West Ham, who have added a lot of names you might know. Mm. I'm not sure any of them are going to take the team to the next level. I think they're just consolidating their position. Whereas Tottenham have pretty much stuck with the team that they've got, and they're going to get better. So it seems to me that seems what it should be all about.
Of course, Kyle Walker leaving and Kyle Walker-Peters coming in. Travis Newton, we were commenting on the singular issue of the similarity of names. Travis Newton writing and saying, forget Walker Peters replacing Walker. Fulham once got John Collins to announce the signing of Collins John. That's nice, isn't
it? Good. I mean, even the fact that Walker may also be replaced by a slower player called Trippier is quite good. Mm. That works very nicely as well.
Yeah. Yes, I suppose it does. So do you anticipate then Spurs triumphing against Chelsea?
I think they're strong favourites. Yeah. I think Conte will try and keep it tight. I think he'd be delighted with a 0-0 this weekend. But I think it's, yeah, Tottenham's game to lose here.
All right. Last time he had a massive defeat in the Premier League, or certainly the famous defeat last year in the Premier League against Arsenal, he responded by shaking things up and bouncing back with an extraordinary winning run. Is that what we're going to see the start of this weekend, James?
I think we saw last year Conte's flexibility. He was willing to change. I know everyone thought that he would at some stage go to a back three, but I don't think that was in any way inevitable at all. I think we are all looking at this now and thinking he's maybe just going to ask a few players to play out of position, say move Luiz around. But we might see him change to another system. Just before the start of the season, he said that the 3-4-2-1 that they started playing last season, that was from a week's sort of training and preparation. It wasn't something that they'd worked on in particular in pre-season. Mm. But, you know, I mean, let's not forget they have a very good player in Morata who did what Morata always does when he came on last weekend, which is in limited game time, really affect the game, score goals, set up goals. And yeah, he's lethal. He doesn't need much to change the game for his team. So I think he'll probably start instead of Batshuayi, which, again, will give maybe a different look to that Chelsea team from the one that started against Burnley.
All right, interesting. Of course, the Spurs have Harry Kane, but not only are they playing at Wembley, but they're playing at Wembley in August, and he doesn't score in August, David. It's a fact.
Why don't they drop him?
Maybe.
Why don't they play somebody else?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Janssen definitely won't score in August. Yeah. Any other one.
At least it might just hit Kane. Yeah.
All right. Then. So you're thinking Spurs, your draw?
Yeah.
Okay. And David?
I'm going to say definitely Spurs.
Definitely Spurs. Right. Okay. Well, plenty of other exciting things to look forward to this weekend. I wonder what we're going to talk about next.
Tweet us at The Totally Show and find us on Facebook and at thetotallyfootballshow.com.
Liverpool are up against Crystal Palace this weekend at Anfield. A slightly shaky start for Jurgen Klopp's side away at Watford, but they followed that up looking pretty special. Did you see them midweek against the Hoff, David?
Yeah, I watched the game, yeah.
All right, what did you make of it?
I think it was exactly what the Liverpool have been like for, even under Brendan Rodgers. Mm. It was great going forward. And for the life of me, it baffles me that a team can have such a problem defensively, especially from set pieces. And not just from set pieces, the goal they conceded could have been avoided as well. The fact that it doesn't seem to have been rectified, doesn't seem to have been worked on. And the only way to really work on this, especially from set pieces and defending set pieces, is just repetition, repetition, repetition. And it doesn't seem to be getting any better. And are they working on it in training? Possibly. Are they working on it long enough? Probably not.
Probably not.
I mean, they didn't concede from a set piece this time, but they almost did in the 91st minute from Hübner. He had a free header.
Well, this is it. And then everyone's looking around. They're looking at each other, thinking who's be picking up. And I know there's this argument about zonal marking, but that doesn't make any difference whether people are zonal marking or man marking. There's no difference whatsoever. And I think the fact that it's people came into question against Watford. They questioned Simon Mignolet a couple of times. His part in the first and the third goals. When really, I think Simon's, since he come back to the side, he's been a different keeper. He looks much more confident, much more assured. He's much more solid. He kept him in the game the other night. It was quite open. There was some chances on both sides. Game against Hoffenheim. I think they could have easily, lost a couple of goals. But in one-on-one situations, he's strong, and especially in penalties as well.
Yeah.
So all right. Seven now since he's been at Liverpool.
Is that right?
Yeah. So that's something you maybe associate with him. Yeah. Mm. But I was quite taken aback by that. But at the same time, Kramaric's penalty was pretty poor. It was more or less straight at him. But yeah, as you say, kept him in the game. And It was interesting to see how Klopp's analysis of that game was completely different to Nagelsmann.
What did he say? What did Klopp say?
Klopp said we allowed Hoffenheim to play into the spaces that we wanted Hoffenheim to play, so that they wouldn't hurt us. And Nagelsmann really kind of bristled at that and said that we had four or five big chances ourselves. He seemed to have a bit of a chip on his shoulders, though, kind of. Klopp was belittling him. Certainly showed a lot of kind of character, this young 30-year-old coach calling out his much more famous counterpart.
Indeed. Speaking of young people doing well, we haven't mentioned Trent Alexander-Arnold yet. Ilyas Najib saying, if Trent Alexander-Arnold is this good, I honestly can't wait to see what Trent Alexander-Arnold-Peters will be like. He had I know he was possibly a little bit suspect on Hoffenheim's goal, but he did have a pretty outstanding game.
Yeah, I thought he did well. I mean, I thought it also helped when you looked at Liverpool's shape that Emre Can seemed to come across and kind of protect him throughout that game. It was only really after he scored the goal where he seemed to get a lot of confidence from that and get forward a little bit more. But of the fullbacks who got forward for Liverpool and maybe took a few more risks, Moreno typically was that one. Arnold seemed to stay back a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, as Klopp said afterwards, to step over and say that I want to take that free kick and score it in the manner he did at that moment in the game. Well, I personally thought that it was a very even game. Hoffenheim had more of the ball. They had some really good chances, as Nagelsmann alluded to, kind of set the ball rolling for them.
All right. David, I know you're not very happy with the keeping on that.
Not really. I'm always impressed by Bowen. Yeah. Always. I think he's a solid goalkeeper, technically sound. But my theory from this, it was about 29, 30 yards out. He's got a wall 10 yards away. And I still think that any shot without a wall, if you put, I've said this many times, if you put a player 30 yards out and just a goalkeeping goal and nothing in between them.
No wall.
If it's just, for example, on a training ground,
yep.
And there's just the two players, very rarely would they beat the keeper from that distance.
Okay. So basically, do you just allow the keeper the advantage of being able to see everything that's happening, and he's got time from 30 yards out to react to whatever the ball's doing? But then the opposition, the attacking team could put their own wall in then.
Well, that's it. But it's about evolving and making the other team think and making them change their tactics and having to change what they do ordinarily to defend free kicks and corners and right. set pieces. But say, for me, for my personal choice from that distance, I would have two in a wall just to cover the left-hand post, and it puts up a small obstacle, puts something in their eye line, something to distract them a little bit, but it gives you a much clearer look at the ball, and the earlier you pick up the flight of the ball, the quicker your response can be. And, and I think even in that situation, Bowman, he moved to his left, but he didn't dive, and that's simply because from a 30-yard free kick, when he sees the ball, is when it passes the wall. So right. it becomes a 20-yard free kick and it's coming at him quicker because it's already it's got pace on the ball.
I like this idea. I'm even more excited by the other one that you were mentioning before we came in here.
Yeah, so...
This is quite radical, actually.
So, I did a piece in the Times today, and it was basically just saying that what I've just said, that we shouldn't need walls from that distance. So I spoke to Tim Dittmer, England under-21 goalkeeping coach, and we discussed a few ideas, how to be a little bit innovative and just and try and create something that can distract the take of the free kicks. Now, he's all for distracting the thought process of the taker. So in this situation, or perhaps from 25 yards, he would set up a wall 15 yards away. So straight away, the taker's thinking, what's going on here? Because you're giving him a lot more space. He's used to every day when he's practicing after training, he's kicking 20, 30, 40 balls. It's from a static wall, 6'2" high, from the same distance, and he's hitting them over there, just repetitive. Now you put that wall back, and he starts it changes his thinking process, thinking, well, what's
you're in his
now?
Head, aren't you?
Well, yeah, exactly. And the way his perspective, the way he sees the goal, does he see more of it, does he see less, how does it affect him? And then as he's about to approach the ball to take it, then the wall starts moving towards him. Now, even if he aborts his run and thinks, right, I'm going to take a free kick again, then just move back again, and then keep doing it and keep moving backwards and forwards. And it's just to distract...
It's like grandmother's footsteps, isn't it? But with football. That's brilliant, David. Is that entirely legal? Would the referee say, hang on, can you stop doing that?
Well, this is it. Yeah, of course, it's entirely legal.
It is.
And the only thing I could possibly think of, they would think it's some sort of ungentlemanly conduct or... but I can't see that. But that's exactly what happened when the first wall was introduced.
Right.
I think it was... In my mind, it was introduced in, I think it was 1947, in a game between Northern Ireland and Italy. Now, Italy were by far superior side at that time to Northern Ireland, as they are now. And Danny Blanchflower, the Northern Ireland captain, he thought the only way they were going to get a result from the game was to do something totally different, just to think, how can we stop them from scoring ordinarily and from what we not usually do? And this was his idea. His idea was to put this wall in front.
Wow.
And now, obviously, the rules...
Did it work? Did they win the game?
Well, this is the thing. It didn't work for this very reason.
Yeah.
It was the first time it had been done. Nobody had ever seen it before. The officials hadn't seen it before. The opposition hadn't seen it before. So then there was confusion all around, obviously, apart from the Northern Ireland ranks. So in the confusion, the Italians picked up the ball... dropped it back 5 yards further so they can get a better sight of the goal.
Right.
Deliver the free kick, scored 1-0.
Wow.
So, I mean, but then it just showed you that even in the...
I'm surprised in light of that anyone else thought, we'll just put a wall, because the Italians scored in that situation.
Yeah, it kind of thinks, well, what was the point of putting the wall up if they scored anyway? But it's great credit to the Italians that they, in fact, moved the ball. Even though that's...
Well, they're tricky people, of course.
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah. But they thought quickly and said, we move the wall back so we can actually get the ball up and over the wall.
Right.
and they scored.
But I like the general message here, Mr. Manager, tear down this wall. I like that. Well, it's time for a rethink on our whole free kick approach. More, please, David, as we saunter through the other topics today. I should just mention we did bill the game away at Hoffenheim as the toughest draw Liverpool could have had. And as such, the 2-1 win, disappointing that they conceded, but it's still a great result to take back to Anfield, where last time they faced a German team, they did pretty well, of course, against Borussia Dortmund. This time at Anfield, they're going to take on Crystal Palace, who are their bogey team. But maybe not this Palace side, managed by Frank de Boer, who's only won one of his last 8 games. And they looked a bit confused against Huddersfield. Did anyone see the game against Huddersfield?
Yeah, they did. That de Boer stat, does that include Inter as well? Yeah.
Very much okay. So. Palace, though, have won on their last 3 visits to Merseyside. Does that include Everton? I wonder if it does. It just says No, that's Anfield. That's Anfield, says okay. Producer Ben. Producer Ben, welcome back, by the way. He's back with us today. He's had his 8-match ban reduced.
Well, what with Liverpool struggling on set pieces, you think Benteke he's got to get chances.
Mm. But is De Boer the kind of manager who's going to put it in the mixer?
Yeah, I think that's the issue.
I don't know.
Was a subliminal plug for your book there.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Cheers.
You put lots of things in the mixer. Brilliantly done, James. Mm. Yeah.
Thanks.
How's your book's launch? How's it doing?
Yeah, very well, thanks. 25th anniversary of the Premier League this week, of course. Mm. So, you know, why not read the history
that's
of
perfect.
It?
Perfect. As if you needed an excuse to read the mixer. Of all weeks, this is the one to do it. Okay, Liverpool, they might be a bit tired from their midweek activities. And, of course, they're going to be with that whole bunch of players. Lallana, Sturridge, possibly Klein too, although who needs him these days. And Coutinho, because has there been any word, Coutinho?
I don't think there has been any word, but they haven't. They didn't miss him the other night. Yeah, I suppose this feeds into this whole debate about the transfer window.
I guess it does.
And whether it should already be closed.
Yeah, but that seems a bit daft to me. If everyone else has got their transfer window still open, how can you...
Well, yes, but I mean, if they all were to fall into line and do it themselves...
But all the seasons start a different weekend, so how are you going to do that?
Well, for example, this debate was already had in Italy last year, and it was Allegri, the Juventus manager, who suggested that the transfer window should start at the end of last season rather than you have this kind of ridiculous kind of arbitrary delay,
yeah,
and then it should close on July 15th. So that all the teams can go into training camp with all their teams settled. You're not having players doing what they're doing now, for example, which is going on strike. There are players across Europe from Ousmane Dembele, Coutinho, in Italy, Keita Balditao, all not training. You've got games where these players are unavailable. Coutinho unavailable for the Hoffenheim game. Keita Balditao unavailable for the Italian Super Cup. Bundesliga starting this season, Dembele.
This weekend, yeah.
This weekend. So that
does sound pretty sound thinking. Of course, you might have issues in some ways where you have, say, a World Cup, but then hopefully they're moving those things to Christmas from
Well, this was Allegri's other recommendation, which was to actually have, instead of the second transfer window in January, have it in November, which is what they used to do. Because his thinking on that was, if you have a transfer window in January and you sign players on deadline day in January, by the time those players kind of settle in, absorb your kind of tactical ideas, know what they're doing, it's kind of too late for them to make an impact.
Right.
But if you can bring them in November for maybe like a 10-15 day period, they've got more chance of affecting the game. Also, players who haven't been playing from the start of the season and are out of favour, they can find a solution quicker, and
tell you what, if you're a fan of statues, we're kicking them over, topically enough, actually, on today's Totally Football show. Fantastic. What do you think, Michael, about Everton and their signing of Gylfi Sigurdsson? Now, my question to you at this point is, how big a difference does he make? This is a club that finished a significant distance off the top 6. What does he specifically bring? Does he bring enough to actually make them anything more than just more comfortable in 7th?
No, I don't think so. I think he's a very good player for a bottom half team, but I think he's the type of player who kind of needs the team built around him. If you look at his stats last year, they're very, very good in terms of chances created, but an incredible number from set pieces. In fact, almost all of them from set pieces. Everton have quite a good set piece taker in Leighton Baines already. I think Sigurdsson is... He's one of the few players around these days who I think you can call a highlights player. He looks good in highlights. You watch him in 90 minutes, he doesn't look so good. I think that concept of the highlights player has kind of gone away. Now there's so much live football. now players are kind of assessed in depth in terms of stats. But I think his overall impact on games is kind of negligible. And I think really we'll see the kind of Tottenham Sigurdsson where there's a couple of flashes of brilliance. But I'm not sure he's going to take them to the next level at all. No, and they've also got quite a lot of players in that mould already, really.
So why have they spent 45 million on him?
Well, I don't know. I mean, he is a player capable of spectacular moments. But, you know, I guess the Ross Barkley thing feeds into this. They expected him to leave. Mm. It now looks as if he's got a fairly serious injury that could keep him out for a couple of months, in which case maybe he'll be sticking around until January. So I think it's a bit of a strange one, to be honest. To me, it smacks of a club who've got a lot of money to spend, want to make a statement about their ambition, but I'm not sure it's really ambitious buying a bottom half level player.
Well, I mean, they've spent 100 million, I think, if not maybe a little more this summer, on players who played for teams that finished, I think, 15th, 16th and 20th.
Mm.
So, I mean, those players were very good players for their own team. So Pickford, for example, player you're paying potential there. Keane as well, he would play for a top six club. But still, I think that it just goes to show that figure further underlines just how much money is swimming around in the Premier League. And Premier League to Premier League club business is just ridiculous. When you, for example, compare the money paid for Sigurdsson and Juventus this week
with Blaise Matuidi,
£18.2 million.
So many people have been writing in about that. We'll talk about the Blaise Matuidi move later on, but certainly the Premier League premium is nothing new, but it seems to be ever more exaggerated. Stats for Sigurdsson include the following. He ran more, or he covered more ground than any other Premier League player last season. Did you know that?
I do know.
Oh, yeah. possibly more significant is the fact that over the last three seasons, as a midfielder, only Christian Eriksen has been involved in more goals. Sigurdsson's actually been involved over the last three seasons more than Ozil, Hazard, Fabregas, Mane, Mahrez, Dele Alli, who's played less, of course, over three seasons, David Silva, Philippe Coutinho, and way more than Ross Barkley. Do you see any wisdom to this, David?
I do, simply because I think if his replacement for Ross Barkley has been too inconsistent. At least with, you know what you're getting with Sigurdsson, and I think he's a different player now than he was at Tottenham. And the fact that he's coming, you know, you're talking about him being involved in a lot of assists with set pieces, I think it'll be crucial. I know that they've got Leighton Baines, but it gives them so many more options. And I think at that level, and if you look at the game Saturday, they won 1-0 Saturday. If they're involved in a lot of games like that, it's going to be a crucial factor.
Plus, they're involved in European competition, possibly, depending on what happens a little bit this evening, when in the Europa League playoffs, they're up against Hajduk Split out of Croatia. Gareth Barry's left, he's gone to West Brom. And Everton, meanwhile, are going to be heading off to the Etihad this weekend. When's that? Oh, it's on Monday, isn't it? Monday night. What do you think is going to happen, James?
Well, Everton used to have a good record going to play against City under David Moyes. Mm. I think that's changed now. This was one of the games of the season last year, wasn't it? Where I think Koeman kind of said that City were the best team that he'd seen by a mile. I think City will have to do better than they did in the first half against Brighton. But I just think they've got to, I think they'll have too much for Everton.
City will have too much. Yeah. Okay. Sigurdsson's old side, Swansea, will be taking on Man United. That's the early kickoff on Saturday, Michael. On one hand, Swansea have a very good record against Man United. They had a 1-1 draw, but then didn't everybody at Old Trafford last season. They've won three of the last five meetings. On the other hand, though, Swansea last weekend, pretty dire in that 0-0 draw with Southampton. No Sigurdsson in that game, and no shots on target neither.
Yeah, I'd fancy United to win this one fairly comfortably, to be honest. A lot of people have said Romelu Lukaku is maybe a flat-track bully, doesn't do it against the top sides. One, I think that's harsh, and two, when you look at Manchester United's record last season, they failed because they weren't, you know, swatting aside the minnows like Swansea, really. Right. So I think it's the kind of game where Lukaku will show his worth.
Right, okay. Well, that's the early kickoff on Saturday. Later on that day, do you know, let me ask you this. What's the biggest misconception in football? David?
There's quite a few
goalkeeper
misconceptions. They should never get beat at the near post. A goalkeeper should never be beaten.
Why is that a misconception?
Well, because power can beat you from any angle.
Okay, that's fair enough. James, have you got a biggest misconception in football?
2-0's the most dangerous scoreline.
But it's true.
It's not. Statistically, since the Premier League began, 90% of the time, a team with a 2-0 lead will win the game. Shake your head.
Michael?
Well, it's something very specific, but I'm frustrated whenever I hear this argument that England wasted Paul Scholes by playing him on the left. It's just a complete nonsense when you look at, you know, his positional history and the situation going into Euro 2004. It just doesn't add up at all.
I'm scratching my head over the people who say that as well. Yeah. One day we'll devote an entire show to that.
Oh, please do, yeah.
But that day is not today. Because my biggest misconception in football is one that I often subscribe to, and it is that Arsenal have trouble at Stoke because they really don't.
Hang on, they do.
No, they don't. They've won five of their last six meetings with Stoke.
With Stoke.
Including a 4-1 at the Bet365.
Okay, okay, but at the Emirates, they've won 9 out of 9.
Right.
And at Stoke, they've won 2 out of 9. That's so it's a problem at, so it's not a problem against Stoke, it's a problem at Stoke.
Was it not Bolton? Didn't they have a problem against Bolton? Then Bolton, Stoke have just replaced Bolton in the
pretty much, yeah. Long balls, yeah.
All right, Michael, with your facts. Well, they're going there again. This, of course, the scene of the famous Get Out Jolie match. You remember at the train station after a Arsenal, I'm not sure what lesson you draw from their performance against Leicester last weekend, except that perhaps anything is possible.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't really see what problems Stoke will give them, to be honest. It's not the Stoke of old. It's not a particularly direct side. A couple of years ago, they were playing very nice football with some really talented players in the final third. I'm not sure they have the real creative presence who's linking midfield and attack. I don't think Stoke are a very good team, actually. I think
they're real problems.
Actually.
They do beat Arsenal 5-1 in one category.
Go on.
The category of having Champions League winners in your squad. Famously with a record Premier League tally of 5.
But they've lost Arnautovic.
Yeah, but they've still got Shaqiri, Bojan, Darren Fletcher and Ibrahim Afellay. And of course, Hesse, who joined this week after his not desperately inspiring spell at, well, half season at PSG and then he was off to Las Palmas. Former Real Madrid player. Is he going to do big things?
I don't think any more so than say Shaqiri. I think that this is they buy players who've got pedigree, have been around elite top players, and have trained with them, but for whatever reason haven't quite made it. And I think Hesse definitely falls into that category, as did Arnautovic in the past. Shaqiri. I'm with Michael on this. I'm not too big on Stoke.
Okay,
but. Arsene Wenger gave a very good interview in France Football this week with our friend Philippe Auclair. Well, he was talking about a range of different things, but among which was how he sees the future of football.
Oh.
In which he does actually think that managers will be replaced by people who'll just basically select the team based on analytics and statistics, and that his role will be just supervising, almost like, and Ranieri's spoken about this as well. It become like an NFL kind of operation,
right,
where you have defensive coordinators, offensive coordinators, and all this, which I always thought there would people like Wenger of his generation would dismiss this and think no. But in Ranieri's case, he thinks it's already happening. There are defensive coaches, attacking coaches, who just purely work with one department of the team.
Right. I'm a bit thick, but isn't Steve Ball doing that?
Well, exactly. And you see at Arsenal, I think it's quite an interesting case there where they actually bought a few years ago a stats company to work and help them in kind of performance analysis, their recruitment and that sort of thing. There's a great line where he was talking about why he basically signed a new 2-year deal. Philippe asks Wenger if he had to choose his successor, who would it be? And Wenger laughs hysterically, apparently. And he says, I'll tell you a story. A manager goes to see a doctor and he asks him, how much longer will I live? The doctor responds, quit your job as manager immediately. Do not drink anymore. Stop smoking. But the manager insists, will you guarantee that I will live longer if I do this? No, not at all, the doctor tells him. But you will feel like you are living a lot longer. Ever since I heard that story, I've decided not to change job.
Right. You can imagine if Arsene went to see a doctor, that they might tell him to quit his job immediately. All right. David, so you were a bit down on Liverpool's set-piece defending and that before. Similar story, I imagine, with the ever-entertaining Arsenal.
Do you know, if we spoke about Stoke there and just saying that they're not as physical a side as they used to be, but I think they'd be stupid to ignore the set pieces this week, especially the way that Arsenal defended them last week. And a big worry for me, if I was an Arsenal fan, would be Petr Cech last week. I'm a huge fan of Petr Cech. But last weekend, it's the first game of the season, everyone has bad games, of course they do. But it was kind of like every time the ball came, especially in two of the goals, he was almost like a toddler caught in the middle, in piggy, playing piggy in the middle.
Oh, yeah.
You know, sort of like indecisive, in between decisions, in between positions, and just not getting anywhere near it, not being on his line, not being be able to get to the ball.
It was a throw-in as well that he made a strange decision to come, and then I thought almost pushed the ball into his own net at one point.
Yeah, and I think it all stemmed just from having a negative starting position. If he's already out there, and by the time the ball comes in, he assesses the flight, and then he's coming forward, and then he's getting nowhere near it. So he just needs to be a little bit more positive with his positions. But it was a big worry for me last week.
Jack Butland back with Stoke.
Yeah, I think that this season, it's a huge season for him, simply because it's the England spot's there for him to be taken. I think these first few weeks until up to the international break,
right.
I think if he keeps performing like the way he has been, the way he finished the season last year, he should be batting for as England number one.
Okay, we'll talk about the whole England situation a little bit later on. But anyway, well, that's going to be an exciting game, or not. We just don't know, but we will be back on Monday to talk about that. There's much more coming up after this on the Totally Football Show.
Men and ladies of the Totally Football Show, why waste time going to the shop to buy overpriced quadruple-bladed vibrating turbo razors and making the likes of Thierry Henry and Roger Federer even richer by doing so? Instead, head to cornerstone.co.uk/totally and pick up a personally engraved razor and six super sharp blades delivered right to your door for just £4. There are no gimmicks with Cornerstone, just a closer, smoother shave than ever before. And it doesn't just work on your face either. I used it on Jimbo's head before we started recording. Head to cornerstone.co.uk/totally to see for yourself. And if you don't love your first Cornerstone shave, they'll give you your money back, no questions asked.
Listeners, hope you've been enjoying the show so far. Not sure what your plans are for the rest of the day, but it could be a long one, this, because there's loads of things still to discuss. Burnley-West Brom's not one of those things, though, Michael.
I think that might be the least appealing fixture of the Premier League season. Just two very defensive teams. Nothing against either team. I think they'll both go quite well.
Right, even after Burnley's terrific performance last weekend at Chelsea.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a bit of an anomaly in the sense that Chelsea had a man down early. I think they'll both go quite well this season. I think I've been surprised people have been tipping Burnley for relegation because they're just so well organised. But they're two teams who don't really like having the ball, and I can imagine it being just quite scrappy, to be honest.
Okay. Leicester are taking on Brighton. Brighton, who spent most of their game against Man City defending. Here's a stat for you, actually. Brighton's keeper, Matt Ryan. Are you a fan, David? Yes, no?
I am a fan, yeah.
Good. He attempted 27 passes, more passes than anyone else on the Brighton team last weekend.
Well, this is the thing. This is his big strength. Now, if perhaps he's not the standard that Pep Guardiola wants, but certainly with his feet, given the license by his manager, he will play the most ridiculous passes and take the most chances, but he can do it. He doesn't give balls away. Now, in the last couple of games, there's been question marks. I think if they play the friendly game, was it against
Atletico Madrid?
Yes. Atletico Madrid, yeah. He made a mistake, a simple mistake, was the long range shot straight at him. But if you look back in, especially in his time in Australia, he plays the ball through the first line of press brilliantly. He doesn't panic at all, and of course it's in relation to the players around him. They have to move for him and offer themselves as well. But he's brave with ball, very brave, and far better with the ball than Claudio Bravo.
Better with the ball than Claudio Bravo. Okay. Well, anyway, that's Leicester Brighton. Also this weekend, Huddersfield, who excited everybody so much with their 3-0 win away at Crystal Palace last weekend, will be hosting a Newcastle team that will feature no John Joshelvy, no Lejeune, and probably one or two other players as well. So that could be another, it looks like another favourable fixture, that one for David Wagner.
They won at St James's this time last year as well.
3-1. That is so very true. Bournemouth are up against Watford. Yes, they are. Here's a game that I want to talk about. Saints against West Ham. Now, Richie Sombrero And that's by far the greatest name that we've featured in the show this week. Rich Sombrero says, how will Saints do? Very bullish about keeping Van Dijk and the Chinese takeover finally through. Chinese buying 80% of Southampton. So big changes there in terms of their potential and possibly the way that they're managed. Although I think the old kind of directorial structure is still in place. And any thoughts particularly about Saints?
Well, Saints struggled to score last season and they struggled to score last weekend. They're on a club record 6-game streak without scoring a goal.
Yeah,
Manolo Gabbiadini.
Yeah, 6 games at home without scoring.
Yeah, and Manolo Gabbiadini, who obviously came in January and really hit the ground running, seemed to solve that problem. He's struggling as well.
Well, he went close last weekend against Swansea. Here's some good news for him. He's facing Joe Hart this weekend. Now, it's the 25th anniversary of the Premier League. And there's, you know, all the kind of shows and the great moments and all that. And particularly, what was it, 11-12, the Man City last-minute win, etc. And you see Joe Hart running and celebrating with it. And he just seems such a promising figure. And he seemed clearly destined for really top level in terms of being a goalkeeper. What has happened to him, David? Were we deluding ourselves in terms of what he was capable of? Or has his game gone massively backwards?
I don't think that he isn't a bad goalkeeper. He is a very good goalkeeper, but to compare him in terms of likes of Buffon, no, you can't do that.
Is he a worse goalkeeper now than he was, say, 2-3 years ago?
Yes.
And what is it that's happened to him?
I think whether it's down to a change of goalkeeping coach, there's some flaws in his game that have crept in, some that have become worse. I think the fact that he's such a confidence player,
right?
And you could see that the fact that the way that he acts before games in the tunnel, and it's all. I quite often find players like that. It's all a mask. It's all bravado,
right?
And the fact that that his confidence has clearly been knocked simply by the rejection first at City and then obviously by his performances last season.
Yeah, where he was dubbed the biggest problem that Torino had by Torino's own owner. And the issues at Turin were, what, getting beaten to the left? That was one key.
Well, getting beaten to the left was a weakness that he supposedly had at City. But really stunned people in Italy was how he kept conceding the same goal, which was a cross would come in, usually to the far post. He'd try and go and claim it, fall on his backside. The goal would be open and the opposition would score. And the number of times Torino lost points because of that was sizable.
But this is the thing about goalkeeping coaches and the input that they have into his game, because it was clear that from the first game, actually, that anything wide, especially out on the opposition's left-hand side, his positioning was, he was creeping far too near his front post. So anything that's in the back half of the goal, he's really struggling to get there. And he's squared up to the plate and he's running backwards instead of being a little bit deeper in the middle of his goal and turned with his body open to the rest of the player so he can shift his feet across and move his feet into the back post area. He just doesn't give himself a chance of getting in that area at all. And it wasn't rectified. I'd went through every game last season, and in every other game it was happening. They weren't conceding goals every game, that, but it was a constant problem to his game. And the fact that it was never picked up on has to be questioned his coach as well.
You've got Butland, who we mentioned. You've got Pickford. You've got Fraser Forster, I suppose, arguably at Saints. Is Joe Hart even in England's top three now?
Yes, but he's not the top two.
Okay. Who would number one be, Jack Butland?
Yes, but I also think... I thought last season that Manchester City, I know they were tracking him early and possibly might have made a bid in January had he not been injured. They were making sort of very tentative inquiries about him. But I think they missed a trick by taking there. I quite like Edison. He's aggressive in the same fashion that Pickford is. He's, as opposed to Claudio Bravo, he's not frightened of coming through bodies.
Right.
It doesn't matter how far out it is. Sometimes he comes out further and crosses than I go on my holidays. He's positive. But and like I said, he's strong and he doesn't mind that physical contact as well.
Right. The producer Ben just pointed out, I didn't mention Tom Heaton. What an oversight. Would he make the top two?
Do you know, I think he was very unlucky last season not to have been included in the latter games, qualifying games, simply out of merit. He performed solidly. You have to say that, of course, he's playing in front of a very solid unit in front of him. But
he's still making loads of saves, though, isn't he?
But this is it. I mean, you still think, look at Buffon. Buffon's been playing, he's the best keeper, in my eyes, the best keeper ever. But also, he's been allied with the best defensive players in front of him as well. Mm. So it's been a great combination. And I think on a different level, Burnley and Heaton are good matches. Well.
What is it about Buffon, slightly heading off on a tangent, that for you, what is the attribute that makes him the greatest goalkeeper that's ever played? What's the one thing that he does better than anybody else then?
For me, the first thing that I noticed him when I started analysing his game was how deep he played in his goal. Now, from a young age, when I was taught positioning and coming out to narrow angles and things like that, it was I'd always adjusted, so you're always backwards and forwards. Similarly, like we talked about this wall, you know, sometimes you come forward 6 yards out, sometimes. He's always very deep on his line. So what that does, the same as what we talked about the free kicks, it gives him that little bit, split second more to see the flight of the ball. And he's not in a fashion of a keeper where we presume that continental keepers are very sort of flamboyant. Because he gives him that, and they parry a lot of balls like an Oliver Kahn, say, he gives himself that little bit of extra time so that he's allowed to, he can choose whether to parry or catch the ball, and more often than not, he catches the ball.
Brilliant.
Unless they win the Champions League.
Yeah, unless they win the Champions League.
Just let that sink in.
Talking about final seasons.
Hey.
Because I was just getting over Francesco Totti's farewell.
Mm.
But did you see what he did whilst he was on a boat this week? These boats, they were sailing off Ponza.
Oh, yeah.
A ball had gone in the water, and someone on his boat fetched it out. And there's another
boat. Did he dive?
No. There's another boat, maybe 25 feet away,
yes,
saying, that's our ball.
Yeah.
And Totti picks it up, and this guy says, pass it to me. And he plays this incredible pass from boat to boat in this cove, just straight into it.
Where can we see this, James?
YouTube. Or I can flag it on Twitter.
That's been a broad-ranging chat, and here are some of your questions, actually, people have been sending in on Twitter. Ian Mason, Sunderland start to the Championship, stop the rot, That's one for you, David.
They have. I think it's the best start of the season since 98-99, which we'll take after pre-season, sort of losing 3-0 to St Johnstone, then 5-0 to Celtic, which proves we're not good enough to be in the Scottish Premier League.
Maybe the Kazakh League with Astana afterwards, yeah.
Possibly. But yeah, it's, you know, Simon Grayson was being he was the best candidate for this moment in time.
All right.
Simply because the situation with the club's owners, he wants to get rid of the club, and now he's decided I'll stay another year. So this is a year where the ship needs steadying.
Okay. Is it a steadying ship year, or could they possibly move on up again?
I don't think they've got the firepower to do it. Graben and Vaughan are very workmanlike. They grind defences away. Ian McGeady's the one player with a bit of craft and guile who can do something.
Who saw Real Madrid's performance in the second leg against Barcelona? Another goal, another peach of a goal from Asensio. JP says, can anyone stop Real Madrid in this season's Champions League? It's a little bit early to go with that, but they did look impressive. And so much love for Luka Modric and his performance in that game. Oh,
there was one bit where he flicked the ball up onto his knee in a over. I think it was Andre Gomes. Wonderful bit of skill. I think Real Madrid can go three in a row in the Champions. I don't think it's too early to call, because
the
depth that they've got, I'm sure Filippo would agree, is that you see what they've done this summer in the transfer market. They've just essentially got all of the kind of next best Spanish talent that isn't Saúl. It's ridiculous their strength in depth and their kind of succession planning. Which you look at Barca. Barca have really been found wanting in that regard.
Yeah. So they have Barcelona scrambling to try and catch up and strengthen before the Liga season gets underway. They brought in Paulinho from China, and still in for Coutinho and Ousmane Dembele as well. That is surely only a matter of time at this point, is it?
Not sure. Apparently, Dortmund haven't heard from Barca in, I think, 9 days.
Really?
So, I mean, there's still time, obviously, left in the transfer window. He clearly wants to go there. But, it's a case of, I imagine Liverpool with Coutinho and also Dortmund with Dembele, they'll probably be playing for time in some respects to how they might go about spending that money.
Right, if, that's fair. Yeah.
But the Barcelona performance last night was, I mean, it was absolutely shocking. It was honestly the worst I've seen Barcelona play for coming up to a decade. It was just incredible. Wow. Just the shape of the team was all wrong. They were almost playing this counter-attacking system, which is just everything Barcelona haven't been about for 10 years or more. Busquets had definitely the worst game I've ever seen him play. He was just constantly being dispossessed on the edge of the area. And you just wonder really how that can be solved by the addition of Coutinho, really, who's I don't think is the kind of player that they need. I think it's just,
who do they need, Michael?
Well, a wide forward makes sense. They have to have someone who can play broadly in the Neymar role. But Coutinho, for me, doesn't really fit into either the left wing position or particularly into midfield. He'd do better in midfield, but why they're thinking of spending quite that much money on a good player. But he's nowhere near that level, in my opinion. He's barely played in a good team in his career. He's never been close to any individual awards. He's a nice player to watch, but I don't think he's going to transform Barcelona from the state they were in yesterday.
Do you think Eriksen would be a better fit?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, and the number of, you know, even you look at a Serie A, you look at someone like... Yeah, but even if you're talking about midfield players, someone like Borja Valero, I think, can do, you know, he's a Barcelona-type player more than Coutinho is. Mm. I think it's a very strange move for
Could
Coutinho.
You see when Piqué went off,
yeah,
the Bernabeu was trolling him, saying, stay, like his tweet for Neymar.
David, if you haven't seen it, the first goal yesterday, a lot of people were questioning Ter Stegen. Because he didn't dive. It was a dipping
but the
shot
thing is,
from 25 yards, and that was a big...
Asensio scores this goal quite a lot. He scores long-range goals. And the way he strikes the ball, it's unlike any player I've seen before. It's I mean, that was... It really looped over Ter Stegen. And you could kind of understand where he thinks, oh, maybe that's going over the bar. What an incredible player. He scored in four of the five finals he's played in. And you think...
And he could have been Barca's.
He could for 3.8 million.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? Funny how things turn out. Listen, we still quite a lot to get through, but looking very, very impressive. Real Madrid, Celtic looking good.
Outstanding.
5-0 against Astana. Danny McGee says, what do Celtic need to go that step further in the Champions League? David, you were impressed with them last night.
I was, yeah. I mean, they did win 5-0, but I think they only had three shots on target.
Really?
Yeah, so it was 2-1 goals. They played, in all fairness, they played deserved it. I thought Astana started the game well, they kept the ball well, they looked confident, but they worked Celtic worked the ball well in wide areas and punished them, and there was it has to be said. And I mean, it looks like I'm coming on and just sort of slating every goalkeeper that I'm talking about, but Alexander Mokhin.
Oh, yeah.
It was very poor in one-on-one situations, bad decision-making, bad positioning.
Yeah, but Celtic, do you think they could get out of the group stage this year?
No.
Okay. What do they need? What do they need to be able to?
I'm always impressed every time I see Lee Griffiths.
Right.
He works tirelessly, but he's a decent finisher as well. He always hits the ball early. That's how they got that. I think it was the fifth goal last night. It took a huge deflection, but it's because he took his shot early. The keeper wasn't set, and in the end, he had no chance. But I'm always impressed by him. But I just don't think they have the quality up front to make the difference in those big games.
Right. They did have some spectacular performances. Obviously, the Man City game. Last season.
Sorry, just say the problem for Celtic and teams who are playing in a similar kind of league, they go into the Champions League group stages, is they just don't have any preparation for the task they've got to do. You know, they have all the ball against most Scottish Premier League teams, and they go to the Nou Camp, they have 25% of possession, they have to play a counter-attacking game. You think maybe if they played that type of game 10 games a season, they'd eventually get into the habit of it, but it's just a completely different task.
Yeah. Interesting. Also in the Champions League playoffs this week, Akinfeev got his third straight clean sheet.
What?
In the Champions League. It's not the Champions League proper, is it? This is in the preliminaries.
That was the greatest own goal that settled that game. I say greatest. It's not even the greatest this summer. But I think it's a guy called Nunu. He heads the ball.
He was the vacuum cleaner in the Teletubbies.
He heads the ball. He attempts to head the ball back to the keeper, but his head, the header is too soft.
Uh-huh.
So he does like a double header, and by that time the goalkeeper's obviously come to get the ball because it's short to him, and he heads it over him outside the box and goes in.
Right.
There's some great goals in the Champions League.
Whoa, none better than Anthony, how do you say this? Nwakwemi?
Yeah.
Yeah. who hadn't ever scored in Europe for or at all, was it?
I don't know. But
in Europe, certainly for Hapoel Be'er Sheva, but a fantastic strike from him against Maribor.
And there's a great lob in the Apoel game as well.
Oh, yeah.
Wonderful chip, yeah.
Oh, and also, Napoli beat Nice 2-0.
Yeah, and looked like they've come through this hex that they were a part of, which was only one Italian team in the last seven seasons has got through the playoffs. But Napoli fully in control, were disappointed that they didn't win by a bigger margin.
Right, because 2-0, that's a dangerous scoreline.
But Milik, for example, missed a sitter towards the end.
And Insigne.
Yeah.
Very wasteful.
A little bit similar to what Michael was saying about Spurs. Napoli have hardly done anything in the transfer window this summer, but that seems to have been a positive because they've kept their best players, like Mertens, like Insigne, for example, tied them down to new contracts. And it's their style of play, the collective, really, which elevates them, makes them such a great team. They play wonderful football.
They were given that first goal, though, weren't they? Just a long ball up to Mertens, and Cardinal is coming up, running out of nowhere, and just lifted it past him. Yeah. It made it easy for him.
I think if there's one...
A cardinal sin.
Yeah.
If there's one fixture I could arrange for this Champions League, it would be Napoli against Tottenham. Ooh. I think that'd be fantastic. Just two really good up-and-coming sides. Napoli are so good at working the ball through the press in deep positions, and Tottenham would be pressing them. I think that would be magnificent.
Well, that'd be great.
Fingers crossed.
Enjoy that. PSG Barcelona obviously would have a certain.
PSG tweeted during that game.
Yeah, that was cheeky, wasn't it?
This photo of Neymar obviously loving life.
Big grin on his face, even while his former teammates were getting done over by their arch rivals. Yeah, I thought that was a little bit. I mean, I've seen some unpleasantness on Twitter of late, but that was took the. But anyway, that Napoli chat, the perfect way for us to wave goodbye to anyone who doesn't want to talk about Serie A, but everybody else who wants to stay and listen, you're making the right choice because a lot of people have come home to Serie A of late, but even more should be doing so this season. It looks like being a great season. It looks like being, James, am I wrong in saying this? The season that Juve's dominance after 6 years is going to come to an end.
It could be. I mean, they've been pretty unconvincing in pre-season. And the sale of Bonucci to their biggest rivals has kind of been framed in the same way that, say, Matic going to Manchester United from Chelsea has. In that, why on earth would you sell one of your best players to a rival like Milan? And I think psychologically that is a big factor. It's going to have to. I mean, Juventus have lost big name players more or less every summer for years, and they've always moved on from there. Particularly in say 2015 when they lost Tevez, Pirlo, and Vidal, and then last year when they lost Pogba and Morata. This year it's Bonucci and Dani Alves, who I think both of them, Alves in particular, was really crucial to them going. Mm. Far in the Champions League again, made them really comfortable at that level. But they're going to have to completely change how they play out from the back. And that's where they've really come unstuck in the game against Tottenham at Wembley and against Lazio in the Super Cup. Pjanic is having to come deep and this centre-back split. And teams are having a lot of fun just basically, sort of reading the play. And putting a striker between those split centre backs and scoring goals for fun. Same goal every game in pre-season they're conceding.
So what's going to happen next year? I mean, how old's Chiellini now?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, Chiellini's obviously in his mid-30s. Well, it's 33, I think. But Barzagli's 36.
Looking at it as well. I mean, more than Chiellini, I would say.
Yeah, I still think Barzagli is a serviceable centre-back. I mean, he was playing at right-back, which he did perfectly fine in the knockout stage of the Champions League last year when Alves was pushed up. But they've got Rugani, who's a very good young centre-back, seen as the future of the national team, and Benatia. But the problem is you've got, as you mentioned, Barzagli, who is old and maybe over the hill.
Mm.
I'm not too sure about that. Chiellini and Benatia, who get injured quite a lot.
Mm.
And then Rugani, and then nobody else. So there's some hope there, but they have signed Blaise Matuidi, who'll help cover that defence.
Right, for 18 million. And they've got a nice favourable opening fixture, which is at home to Cagliari. So a lot of people saying, like Martin Haldane, Gylfie Sigurdsson's 45 million, Blaise Matuidi just the 18.2. How has this happened? James Tortize says, is this the best deal of the year/decade?
Oof. Well, I mean, Matuidi is 30, and this isn't a deal between two Premier League clubs. It's a deal between PSG and Juventus. So there isn't the same kind of money swilling around in this sense. It's, I think, also a deal that was telegraphed last year, because I think I mentioned it the last time I was on, that Matuidi was going to go to Juventus, and then they kind of said, haha, he's not, out of spite. But it does look like a very good deal for that price. Particularly, again, people have looked at the Paulinho deal as well, him going to Barcelona for 40 million.
Right, so if Juve are facing more problems than they have for a long time, which team is going to be their biggest challenger?
I think Napoli, for the reasons that we've said.
Right.
But there's a lot of hype, understandably, around Milan, because they've spent 250 million. It looks like they're putting the final cherry on top as we speak. It's not the striker, I think, that people would maybe have liked, because he's not high profile like Belotti and Aubameyang, but it's Nikola Kalinic.
Oh, right.
Who is actually a very good player.
Yeah, he scores goals.
Scores 15 goals a season, makes the players around him play better. But that team looks like it's been really well put together. And they've got a variety of options. Yeah, I think they were built to play 4-3-3. They didn't expect to get Bonucci. Now they've got Bonucci, they can play 3-5-2. And that probably suits some of the other players they've signed, like Andrea Conti and Frank Kessi, who played that system, for example, at Atalanta.
Right.
So a lot of excitement around Milan. They've been selling out San Siro, 60,000 for that game against the Romanians. Cry over, they're in action against the Macedonian side tonight, Skindia. Season tickets been sold at a rate that hasn't been seen for many, many years.
Right. Well, that's all good. Opening fixture-wise, the most appetising one is Inter against Fiorentina. And Pete Sale, producer Pete, is going to be there. He says, can you give us a special preview in the pod, please? Of course, Pete.
Oof. This is, as you say, a very exciting game.
Right.
Because I think Inter's best signing is the manager, Luciano Spalletti. They were not making as many moves as Milan at the beginning of the transfer window, but I think what they've done has all been quite shrewd. I think Spalletti understands that there was already a lot of talent there at Inter. It was just about kind of knitting it all together. Mm. He's found the players who can do that. Michael mentioned Borja Valero as being a Barcelona fit. I think he's a bargain, really, at four million, I think they've paid for him.
Right. From Fiorentina.
From Fiorentina. Mm. They brought another Fiorentina player, Matias Fassina, so those players know how to play together. I think Inter are a real sleeper. I think they will also be in serious contention this season, partly because of Spalletti. Fiorentina, on the other hand, have lost all of their best players.
Right. They did bring in Diego Simeone's son, Giovanni Simeone, this week.
Yeah, which again has there's a lot of nostalgia around that, not only because of who his father is, because of having an Argentine up front,
right,
like Batigol. So I think that in itself is quite a good signing, and they've signed some very niche players who I think will maybe catch the eye this summer. Milenkovic, he's a centre back from Serbia, and Zecchini, who's I think possible new Salah. So
really
could look good. Yeah,
interesting.
I think they'll really struggle early on. Fiorentina. They've lost all their best players. They've got in Pioli, as manager, who I think is somewhat unconvincing. But to lose, you know, Bernardeschi in particular, that, you know, he was their kind of great hope for the next few years. For him to go to Juventus, it's a massive kick in the face for the fans. I kick it, kick everywhere, really. Yeah.
Yeah. What about Patrick Schick? Is he going to be joining Inter?
Well, it depends, really, because Schick had joined.
Just to preface, in case you're thinking, well, I don't care. You should, because Patrick Schick is one of the most exciting talents out there.
Yeah, he's
Bergkamp-esque.
Bergkamp-esque, and his goals are every bit as good looking as he is as well, because he says that if he wasn't a footballer, he would be a model like his sister, who is a model in LA.
Damn.
But Juventus liked him so much, they went out and bought him at the start of the season, but start of the summer. But he had a series of medicals which he passed, but there were some things that were flagged in that medical which Juventus thought better of basically going through with this transfer. So Inter in particular have not wasted any time in basically saying, look, we would like to sign this player. It does look like the latest medicals he's had are satisfactory, because I think he had a heart problem.
Yeah.
But he is genuinely one of the most exciting players. Yeah, a very tall striker. He can also play off a striker.
Good feet, though.
Very good feet. drawn comparisons with, as you say, Bergkamp, but also plays like Van Basten, Ibrahimovic.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, fair enough. Excellent. Okay. Call the Serie A title race for us, James.
Napoli.
Ooh.
Juventus.
Right. And then?
Inter.
Okay, we should actually make it a top four, because this season, four teams into the Champions League, well, at the end of this season.
Yeah, Milan.
All right. So, Lazio and Roma fans, afraid not. That is, as far as I know, it for this edition of the Totally Football Show, unless there's anything. Dave, where are you going this weekend?
I am Sunderland Leeds.
Are you?
This weekend, yeah.
Okay.
Lick off on Saturday, yeah.
Right. Interesting game for Simon Grayson, that, of course.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. Michael?
I'm nowhere this weekend. I'm just going to be on my sofa constantly watching. All the football started now this weekend, hasn't it?
All the football, yeah. All the time. And yourself, James?
Well, Serie A starts. I'm going to a barbecue. I plan to drink less than I did last weekend.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Yeah. Listeners, let's hope you behave responsibly this weekend. And make sure you join us when we return on Monday with another edition of the Totally Football Show. For now, many thanks to the returned producer, Ben, to Horn Dog Coxie, and our new friend, David Priest. Thank you so much for being with us, David.
Pleasure.
It's been outstanding. Listeners, thanks for being with us, and thanks to Audioboom as well. We'll see you Monday.